is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg, the Poor People's Campaign. In December 1967, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. announced a plan to bring together poor people from across the country for a march on Washington to demand jobs, better homes, better education, better lives. Dr. King was in the midst of organizing the Poor People's Campaign when he was assassinated in Memphis, fighting for the economic rights, for the union rights, and for the dignity of the sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th, 1968. In tribute to Dr. King, to continue his legacy of fighting the three evils of poverty, militarism, and discrimination, the Poor People's Campaign would climax with a Solidarity Day rally for jobs, peace, and freedom on June 19th, 1968. 50,000 people joined the 3,000 participants living at the King-inspired Resurrection City encampment then set up on the Washington Mall to rally around the demands of the Poor People's Campaign. Today, 50 years later, the Reverend William Barber and a new cadre of activists have picked up the reins of Dr. King's Poor People Campaign in the face of systematic racism and the national government's carefully stoked white supremacy, and in response to the greatest disparity in wealth distribution the world has ever known. In response to, as well, the impending ecological devastation and against militarization used against the world's people.
We're delighted to have with us Reverend Graylin Hagler, senior pastor from the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. He spent a lifetime challenging racism, militarism, and poverty, and whose energies are now committed to building the Poor People's Campaign.
Thank you for joining us. Is the circle unbroken between where you and Reverend Barber and the Poor People's Campaign are today and 50 years back, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King? Is this a circle but an unfinished part of the legacy that Dr. King has handed us?
It was an unfinished line of march. In a sense, this is not a new Poor People's Campaign. It's a Poor People's Campaign of old, and particularly a campaign that we've been engaged in almost since the founding of this country, since it was founded upon exploitation and of people and of lives. And so, again, we're continuing that campaign. I'm one of the co-chairs of the Poor People's Campaign in the DMV, as well as pastor of Plymouth Church. So we're continuing to do the work, the agitation, trying to lift up the voice, because one thing is clear is that in this historical time, as well as the historical time of 1968, there's a real intolerance that exists. There's a real xenophobia that exists. There's hatred towards those who are others. Right now, we're dealing with immigrants having their children torn out of their arms at the border. Voter suppression, particularly even last Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that Ohio could purge its voting rolls. All of those kinds of things that we are battling to try to uphold. It's been a narrative that we are currently in the midst of that is divisive, that is racist, that is white supremacist. We need to change the narrative, and the only way you really can change the narrative is apply the pressure that you begin to change the narrator.
Reverend Hagler, you've been at a number of protests, both in Washington, D.C. and around the country. You know, you were at one on the Supreme Court last week. You were one on a labor protest for the deadlock workers at the Arlington Cemetery. Do you want to pick out a couple of struggles that have been building up to this march on rally to give us a flavor of what's been happening around the country?
Sure. I mean, understand, you know, we've been dealing with water rights. I mean, there was water protectors that trying to keep pipelines from coming through sacred land, and not to mention Flint, Michigan, with the kind of lead and pollutants and the water and the poisoning of people because of the consumption of water. Even in Washington, D.C., dealing with water fees that are being attached to people's bills and people who are least able to pay it are shackled with higher and higher costs because over the years, the government in Washington, D.C. polluted the waters, and now it's mandated to clean it up. Nobody's got a problem with cleaning it up, but it's generally how you recoup that money to pay back for it that has basically begun to jeopardize seniors and other poor folks because the bills keep going up. Or a church over in Baltimore that was actually almost foreclosed on because of issues around water cemeteries. And then we're also dealing with the fight for 15, trying to raise up the minimum wage, trying to get to that place where there's really a living wage. You heard me mention the issue around the immigration, kind of draconian things that we're seeing, the kind of merciless things that we're seeing on the border and when it comes to also immigrant communities. And we can talk about health care. I mean, these have all been struggles that have battered people on the margins, people who have been poor have battered. Even those of us who like to think that we're middle class, I always remind folks that we bought into that language of being middle class, but the reality is that many of us are just one paycheck away from being homeless. So we live in an illusion of what of comfort. So it's these economic issues. And if you remember, one thing that Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, he says that an edifice that produces beggars needs to be restructured. And so we really need to look at the kind of economic system that's in place that are continuing to grind up people, keeping people, low-wage workers, very poor, top 1%, basically capturing more than their lion's share of wealth, and all of these kinds of things that are important as we continue to struggle and move forward. And what we're also doing is bringing people together, because very often people operate in their own silos, whether you're talking about LGBTQ issues, whether you're talking about civil rights issues, whether you're talking about the environment. People do the work, and they've done the work very well, but one of the problems has been is that we've operated only in our little territory. And so that has prevented us from amassing the kinds of power that we need to really begin to challenge systems and change the narration and change the structure to continue to batter people.
I want you to continue that theme that you mentioned, that it's systemic. How does one fight a systemic inequity, the history of this country, really, structurally, economically, by changing a moral narrative? How does that give us the intellectual, the spiritual, the political ammunition to restructure an economic system that continues to marginalize and victimize people?
Mm-hmm. First thing is that we got to take our blindfolds off and realize what is taking place around us. I mean, when you talk about poverty, for example, the forces out there have been very clever in trying to, in a sense, make poverty into a racial issue, as if black folks were the only folks that were poor, or Latino folks were the only folks that were poor. But in fact, there's more poor whites in this country. One thing that Lyndon Baines Johnson said a long time ago can make the average white person think that they're better off than the average Negro. You can pick the white person's pocket. And that still holds true. We've seen that in this last election. We've seen that over and over again, because what we really have not dealt with very effectively in this country, the issues of racism and white supremacy and the systematic effects of racism and how that affects people not only economically, but in terms of political power. It affects people in terms of having a sense of empowerment within the culture. So we're talking about systemic racism, systemic poverty. So all of this is sort of like really as a part of the system. But the first step is to wake people up to the kinds of contradictions that exist so that people can see themselves reflected in the issue and therefore begin to see themselves reflected in the solution. That's one thing that we're doing in terms of the demonstrations, marching, singing, putting out position papers, and particularly our moral audit that's been put out, is to get people to begin to take off the blindfolds and realize that they're not okay, the country's not okay, and it involves all of us.
We don't usually hear this kind of discussion even on CNN or MSNBC, which tend to resist Trump. We don't get the economic issues coming through. Do you feel that also? Do you feel as if this campaign has been covered adequately?
Well, the Poor People's Campaign has not been covered adequately at all. You know, I just had a meeting with the managing editor of the Washington Post today to raise the issue, because there was two articles, very superficial coverage. Even if you don't want to cover the Poor People's Campaign, cover the kinds of substantive material that has come out of the campaign in terms of the study and the audit. And then people can go and take a look at that by going online to poorpeoplescampaign.org. But it's not being covered. It wasn't covered in this way. You had all the presidential debates, and not one time in the presidential debate did anybody talk about poor folks. Did anybody talk about people on the margins? I mean, they may have talked about against immigration, those types of things, but what they were talking about was tax breaks that really ends up being tax breaks for the wealthy and all that other type of stuff. And not once did we really even deal in the political discussion around the economic issues in a substantive way.
What I go back to when I listen to you is W.E.B. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction, when he talks so eloquently about the hows and whys psychologically and actually white overseers in that case identified with, when they were in oppressed conditions themselves, the issue of white supremacy, because they could always in effect aspire by virtue of their color at least to be the plantation owner. What I'm interested in here is how the Poor People's Campaign begins to take that intractability of white supremacy, which is a good part of what the Trump administration uses to stoke the flames for support for its own policies. How does that become something that is also fought against? How does one begin to make a white working class people and others, it's not just the white working class, not identify with their oppressors by virtue of white supremacy? Where does the Poor People's Campaign fit into that? And that's a really difficult issue.
Well, let me go back, because we really exist in a context of illusion and hoping beyond hope. What I mean by that is that not too long ago, former President Obama did a State of the Union address, and his responder was Jindal out of Louisiana.
Yeah, Bobby Jindal.
I'll never forget what Jindal had to say. He said, "The president would want you to believe that we are a country of haves and have-nots. We Republicans believe that we are a country of haves and those who hope to have." Mm. And he defined it in that statement. It was a clear definition of how the illusion works, so that people, in a sense, hope to have and are hoping and wishing and working on a pipe dream. And, of course, part of that is being a beneficiary of the hope because you're whiteness. And that's a part of what exists. Now, what also that we need to understand is that Trump, he tapped into this whole idea of people and their economic issues and their economic fears. And part of what we're trying to lift up in the Poor People's Campaign is those economic issues, those economic fears, are not being resolved by xenophobia. It's not being resolved by immigrant hatred. It's not being resolved by any of those things, whether somebody kneels for the flag or stands for the flag. It's not being resolved there. But the real issue is can we provide health care for everybody? Can we provide clean drinking water for everybody? Kinds of economic foundation that allow people to really actually thrive. And so as long as we exist in that issue of delusion, there will be people who will not look and will not come over. But on the other hand, there are people who, once their eyes are open, they come over. And one of the things that's been going on is that we have stereotyped the faith community in that somehow the only people that are considered by commercial media as part of the religious community are those on the evangelical right. Well, the reality is that there's far more people who have been elsewhere, been doing things around immigrants, around employment, housing, all of that, that are also part of the faith community, but one, never get covered, and two, has not really been activated until now. They're in every single community. They are white, they are black, they're Latino, they're Jewish, they're Muslim, they're Native people, everybody coming from different places. And basically to tap in and to activate that community is to get to that constituency that you're talking about, but it's also, in a sense, to elevate the voices of faithfulness, the voices of justice.
So, Reverend Hagler, tell us more about this demonstration, this rally, this march on Saturday the 23rd, and what's the strategy after that?
Well, it is bringing folks together from our various campaigns that have been taking place around the country. A great speak out, a great demonstration, where we're able to see the length and the breadth of the movement that has existed in 40 different states and the District of Columbia. And in that, to draw strength, to draw empowerment, to realize that we are not alone, that everybody who've been operating in their states have been operating in concert, people that they knew were there, but people that they have not seen, people from the faith community, from all walks of life. It'll be people from different communities, people who don't necessarily have faith, but are people of conscience and believe in some things. So in that, I would say that they have faith too. So to come together and the statement that we're making on the 23rd is that even though we have gone through these 40 days, this is not the end. This is a statement This is the inauguration of the campaign that's going to continue. And all of the state and local apparatus that have been built will go back and get to work and do all that they have been doing and do more in order to begin continue to challenge the system, because what we've done and what we are doing is building a whole fabric of networks out there. And clearly we're saying that we're going on, we're going forward, we're going to make a change.
This phenomenal activity, which isn't the culmination, it's just beginning to pick up steam, the Poor People's Campaign. But one of the things that Reverend Barber said that I thought was most critical is it's not about a fight against Trump, as detestable as he may be personally in my thoughts, but it is against the Trumpian policies. There's been lots of evidence now that it really wasn't just the economic insecurities of white people that promoted Trump. It was the fundamental strain that courses through the bloodstream of this country, which is the strain of white supremacy. So when Ken asked how you see proceeding, indeed, how do we proceed with those things? And how does the Poor People's Campaign take up the issues, which is an ongoing struggle? How does it continue? How do we get involved from here on out? And of course, everybody will after the 23rd, without a doubt.
And I think that, you know, everybody, the state apparatuses, so they need to get into the state apparatus. You can, like I said, you can go to poorpeoplescampaign.org and find out where and who is operating in your area if you're not yet a part of it. Number two is one of the weaknesses have been is that we have reacted to those who have what we perceived as being in power. This is a matter of building our own action, our own power, not as a reaction to, but as an action for. To build it, because we can talk about Trump all we want, but the reality is, if Trump was gone tomorrow, the conditions would still exist around health care, around water, around voting rights. So all those issues would still exist. They would not have gone anywhere. So in a sense, you know, there is that whole ideology that exists out there that Trump has rode to power. And so we got to continue to struggle against those and make a big difference by not reacting, but acting and building and bringing people in and lifting up the voices that need to be lifted up, particularly the voices of those who have been impacted.
And I have to say, with people like yourself who have been involved for decades and decades in the challenges to racism, to militarism, to poverty, you've been picking up the thread. Indeed, you were part of that thread all these many years that was the Poor People's Campaign. And so this time, we're carrying it forward with your leadership, with the Reverend Barber's leadership, and the leadership of the people. We need less charismatic leaders and more charismatic movements. And I think the Poor People's Campaign is on the verge.
And let's not forget Reverend Liz Theo Harris, who has been the co-chair there along with Reverend Barbara.
We not only won't forget, we are excited. We make it every one of the states and a truly national Poor People's Campaign, a people's movement for people's empowerment. Reverend Graylin Hagler, thank you for your decades of work, for speaking us to us.
Great, and thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And we are going to hear the final words from the Reverend Dr. William Barber, president of Repairers of the Breach, an author, preacher, and professor. He is the chief architect of the Forward Together Moral Monday movement and the Poor People's Campaign. Let's listen.
We need a fresh wind. Language and vision or illumination and fire are important, but the text says the first thing that happened was the wind. We need a new moral fusion movement blowing in every community across this land. Same folk who are attacking public schools, attack health care, the same ones do that, attack the LGBT community, the same ones that do that, attack labor, attack Muslims, attack the immigrants, attack voting rights, attack living wages. And if they're cynical enough to blow a foul wind, then we have to be courageous and yielded enough to be a part of a fresh wind. Because America needs more than a strategy to win back some seats for Democrats in 2018. We need a new moral Pentecostal wind. that begins to blow against racism and poverty and the war economy. We need a wind that will blow us right out of this chapel, right down south, right in the Rust Belt, right in the Wheat Belt, and even in the places of New York that some people feel are off limits. We need the kind of wind that blew them out of that upper room, and they were no longer afraid of that Caesar who loved to build towers. They were no longer afraid of that Herod who built and put his money on the faces of the corn. And I'm convinced that some of what we're seeing is the last gasp of an order that is passing away. Pentecost in Acts tells us that 2,000 years ago, people were impressed by folks speaking in other tongues that weren't their own. Tongues got the ears' attention. The fire caught the eyes' attention. But the real miracle of that day was the wind blew people together that otherwise would be torn apart. One writer says to us in this moment, he says, the combination of economic anxiety, the insatiable greed of the Koch brothers and their ilk, and a barely subliminal racism against a black man serving in our country as president set the stage for what we see now. And then Donald Trump appropriated much of Sanders' rhetoric about Wall Street, bankers, billionaires, and the globalized economy. He added his own Trumpian vitriol against immigrants, African Americans, Muslims, gangs, drug dealers, and women. And to many people, they bought the con. But history shows that just getting rid of Trump will not fix everything that has gone wrong. Focusing on his obvious personality disorders may be entertaining, but it's not a winning strategy. This is a historical moment of realignments and transformations here and around the world. There's a fire wind, and Donald Trump is merely a symptom. And so we need a fresh wind. One of the first ways we be a part of a fresh wind is when a few weeks ago we announced the Souls of Poor Folk, auditing America since the Poor People's Campaign's challenge on racism, poverty, war, and national morality. You don't pass the 50th anniversary of a prophet's death without evaluating what the prophet stood for, where you are and where you aren't. And once you figure out where you aren't, the only way you can honor the prophet is to pick up from there and move forward. We are praying that this audit will begin to blow a fresh wind. We've got economists and poor people and historians and preachers and clergy sitting on this panel doing seriously. Where are we? What? Not in the last 4 years, but in the last 50 years. Not Democrat or Republican, but let's examine the very foundations and the factors that have impacted America on what should be our deepest moral concerns: economic sustainability and poverty, healthcare, education, environmental justice, women's rights, criminal justice reform, the proliferation of guns, voting rights, immigrant justice, not just immigrant rights, immigrant justice. Where are we? And then, because we can't just have a piece of an audit, we've got to have a movement. And so we believe in this moment we've got to not just keep the focus on Trump, but we've got to focus on how do we challenge these systems that create these symptoms. And so we must have a revival, a reimagination, an implementation of the Poor People's Campaign. We can no longer just go and have memorials and commemoration services. That's not how you honor prophets and prophetic movements. We must resurrect and embrace the vision. And we need a new Poor People's Campaign made up of clergy and poor people and artists and academics and people of every race and every gender to come together. And we need a season of resistance, not intermittent marches, but a season of resistance. What would happen if we had 40 days, let's just say in 2018? What about starting on Mother's Day, 40 days? And what if we had clergy, Jewish and Muslim and imams and poor people leading groups of 25 or 50 into state capitals, and then groups of 100 going straight into the Capitol, not only outside in Washington, D.C., but right over to Ryan's office and right over to McConnell's office. And if we had an agenda out of this audit, and what if we began to sit down and every day they had to arrest us for 40 days? And what if we took a part of the poor people's campaigns, but where they went to D.C. and set up camp, what if we set up camp in 25 states and camp in the District of Columbia? And what if Union had three of those days where the president and students and others would lead something into the Capitol in Ryan? What if every seminary across the country holding hand with poor people and people without health care and immigrants? I mean, what if... Yeah, Dr. King had us on the way, had us in the way. The system killed him on the way, and now it's time for us to find a way. We need to find a way to finish. Somebody said, well, what difference will it do? Well, I know one thing. If that many people get arrested for that many days, it's going to at least change the narrative. First, you have to have moral imagination, prophetic imagination, and then you get prophetic implementation, and so we need it, and so we're committed, and I hope you will join us. You can go to breachrepairers.org and begin to sign up, but we've got to build a movement that has some wind, that has some ruach, that began to shake the foundations of this nation. That's bigger than one president, but it's about principle. It's about changing the trajectory of the nation. It's not just a Democratic wind or a Republican wind or independent wind, but a moral wind. And I believe it's time. Right now, to 218, if we do it right, we'll birth a movement that'll last another 15 or 20 years. We have to do it. We've got to have this new tongue and new fire, and we've got to have a movement that puts a new wind beneath the knee. What if for just 40 days, everybody could stay in their silos? You know, Black Lives Matter could do their thing, women could do their thing, environmentalists could do their thing for the other 325 days. But for 40 days, we decide to walk together, children, huh? And decide to not be weary. You know, I think we can do it. Not because I just am, you know, an optimist. I am hopeful. I don't have to walk by faith altogether on this. I can walk by sight. Every major social movement in this nation that's ever been won is because somebody came together and created a new wind. I feel a wind blowing. It's going to blow down south. It's going to blow all over America. We are not going to let the prophet's dream die. It's to... There's a new wind blowing.
The Reverend William Barber. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.